Well, you'd think that in the summertime, kids are outside playing, running around, having all sorts of great activities, that weight gain, that they would actually lose weight in the summer. But there's some recent research, in fact, a nationwide study of weight gain in over 5,000 kindergartners and first grade children in 310 schools across the country, found out otherwise. And we'll talk about the results of that, and also talking about children's weight gain, summer weight gain, with our guest Sue Nitzke, UW Extension Nutritional Scientist, chairs the Department of Nutritional Sciences at the UW-Madison. Really pleased to have her back. And certainly, if you want to weigh in on this, I hope you do. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email at talk@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. Sue Nitzke, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Great to have you with us. Well, what about this study?
You know, I was surprised at the results myself, but actually there were two studies that came out that same year. This was published in 2007. And the other study was from Aaron Carroll in our own pediatrics department. Mm-hmm. And he found very similar results with a group of middle schoolers that he was working with in a fitness program, that they had tremendous gains in fitness during the school year, and everybody was congratulating themselves. And then when the kids came back the next fall, they had regained all their weight. So,
it's kind of an alarming trend, isn't it?
We're starting to believe this is a real phenomenon. And what we had been assuming is that the nasty weather in the winter and holiday eating, and that was sort of the danger period for adults. It must be true for kids, too. But apparently the less structure that many kids have in their lives during the summer is fattening.
Well, is there a difference between, say, Caucasians or Hispanic children, African-American kids?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in this nationwide study that I mentioned, they actually had enough people that they could break out and look at the data for African-Americans and Hispanics. And for both of those subgroups, the increase in weight gain over the summer was greater. And another thing that they found is that when they broke out the kids who were most overweight, they gained the most weight over the summer. So a number of sort of troubling sub-findings of this study that I think really says that we have to pay attention to this and think about what we could do to help turn that around.
Why would childhood obesity be more common in certain racial or ethnic groups?
Oh, boy, that's something that a lot of experts are looking at and trying to understand. It's got to be part genetics, of course. But the fact that the obesity rates have been going up in the last 30 years, the genetics haven't changed that rapidly. So we really believe it's a combination of having a genetic makeup that makes you more vulnerable to changes in the environment, and then the changes in the environment over the last 30 years have been particularly troublesome. That's sort of the prevailing view, although there's very little way you could actually set up experiments to 100% prove it as one or the other.
Yeah. Well, you were surprised. I bet parents probably a little bit surprised, too, to learn that the kids are gaining more weight in the summertime.
Mm-hmm. And so a number of my colleagues, we actually have a coalition on campus that's called, the acronym is WIPOD. It's the Wisconsin Initiative for the Prevention of Obesity and Diabetes.
Okay.
And Dr. Dale Scheller from our department is the chair of this group, and it includes people from the medical school and the College of Engineering and Agriculture and Life Sciences, the kinesiologists from the education school, and people, experts from across campus, and colleagues from the Department of Health Services. And we're putting together a study group to actually see if there are some things that we could maybe design and test some interventions to help.
Yeah.
And this is one of the phenomena that we're looking at to see if there's something that we could put together that would, start making a difference in the other direction.
Well, when kids are in school, children are in school, there's the gym type classes or whatever, mm-hmm. and opportunities to do this. And I'm wondering right away if, they're not on their bikes, they're not playing soccer, maybe they're spending a little too much time in front of the computer or the television, maybe the computer now.
The experts in child obesity at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the agency we call CDC, have looked at this quite a bit, and they're calling it screen time. You know, we used to call it TV time, that you needed to limit the amount of time kids watch TV. And it, like everything in nutrition, it turns out to be very complicated. But, the current belief is, the dominant belief among the experts, is that when kids are watching TV, they're not only sitting still, but they're really sitting still. They're often not even fidgeting as much as they would be if they were doing other things. But they're also getting constant reminders from the commercials that, you know, wouldn't you like a Twinkie or something?
Yeah, sure.
and many families and cultures, sitting in front of the TV with a beverage and or a snack, whether you're hungry or not, is part of the experience. So that combination of sitting still, not using up a lot of energy, and probably eating when you're not even hungry, or taking in calories when you're not even hungry, is, you know, those two factors probably work together.
Yeah.
And nowadays, with the video games being part of the mix, you may or may not be watching commercials, although the number of commercials embedded in various web sites for kids and video games is disturbing. We could talk about that another time. So probably all of these things together. One of the things the authors pointed out is that if you think about kids during the school day, they have opportunities to eat, but it's not unlimited, sort of what we call grazing all day long, which some kids are actually allowed to do more often during the summer. So, you know, parents often, often complain that the kids come home from school and they're ravenous because they haven't eaten since lunchtime. And, you know, maybe if they're home during the summer and food is available, maybe they don't go that long between eating occasions, and, you know, that can start to add up too. So I bet for every single child there's a different kind of mix of factors that go together. And, you know, some kids love swimming, and maybe they actually get thinner over the summer. There were kids who lost weight over the summer in this study. There were thousands of kids, so it wasn't like every single child experienced a weight gain. But by far more kids gained than lost weight over the summer, and they gained more weight than they did for a three-month period during the school year.
Hmm. Well, let's take some calls. Connie and Madison up first here. Connie, hi. Thank you for calling.
What a pleasure to hear this interesting notion about the summer changes. I want to recommend to our listeners a book I've recently finished by Malcolm Gladwell. The name of the book is called Outliers. And in this wonderful book, he's a science writer for The New Yorker, he's trying to explain the context within which individual achievement occurs. And often does a good job of explaining all the various factors that had to be true in the environment of the person before a great achievement like Bill Gates or other outlier kind of achievers, a great hockey player. In one chapter, he looks at the achievement gap between African-American kids and Caucasian, more middle-class kids, and looks at what happens over the summer. In many cases, the Caucasian children are being offered structured programming of some sort that's stretching and continuing their education. And in many cases, that's not true because of the poverty and the family structure that may not be as rigorously advocating for the kids. And that would be true based on poverty line, as not just racial lines. So the interesting thing is that African-American kids do the same as others during the school year, but make significant losses during the summer, whereas the more middle-class kids come back to school not only having not lost, but in some cases having gained. So it sounds like his chapter on that issue mirrors the issue that you're raising about the nutritional losses, the weight gains, and the losses of fitness over the summer.
Yeah, it sounds that way, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think Connie brings up a very good point in that there's a number of sort of child development phenomena that happen as children grow and mature over the summer and during the school year that probably are affected by differences in their routine and how structured their environment is and how much feedback they're getting from adults, et cetera. So you'd be quickly getting out of my area, but I have heard educators say things very similar to what Connie told us about based on this book.
Yeah. Thanks, Connie.
Thanks.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Outliers was the name of that book. Sounds like an interesting book. I'll have to take a look at it myself. Let's go to Joe in Appleton next. Joe, hi to you.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on what I believe is happening here is just to give you a little background. When I was a child, I was born in 61. I'm 48. My parents had 9 children, okay, for one thing. And not that a big family was anything real special back then. There were a lot of them. But if you can try to imagine what it would be like today, the way parenting has changed, there's not a whole lot of people raising that many kids these days. But regardless of that, the only reason that my parents could do such a thing in those times was the fact that you could raise a family on a single income. Today, you can't, unless you're really got a heck of a good breadwinner in the family. And unfortunately, many of those breadwinners are also single parents. With the difference between then and now is not only do we have a lot more single-parent homes, which is extremely hard to find the time to properly supervise your children and their eating habits. But it's also when you do have the time, if you're the breadwinner and the single parent, you don't necessarily have the energy to always be out there participating 100% when you do have the time. People need to have a little time to themselves. So they have a tendency to allow the computer and the television to supervise their children for them, which is unfortunate. I was very fortunate to have a stay-home mother. Mm-hmm. And, being with a lot of kids and stuff, she would oftentimes pack us a lunch and send the young ones off with one of the older ones, and we'd go on a hike or a picnic or some organized activity. There were many times when we were given to an older sibling to spend time at a pool for an entire day and get a lot of exercise. So back then it was like this phenomenon would never occur.
Mm-hmm. You're raising some great points, and we'll ponder those points, and we'll get back to discussing them, Joe, in just a couple of minutes here. Sue Nitzke, our guest today, UW-Madison and UW-Extension nutritional scientist. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest Sue Nitzke, UW-Madison and UW-Extension nutritional scientist, as we talk with her about children's summer weight gain. Join in with your comments and questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Sue, one of the comments we had on Joe in Appleton, raised in a large family, did a lot of things outside, mom at home having a parent at home, talked about the fact that there are a lot of single-parent homes now. What do you think? What's your reaction?
Well, I think Joe brought up some very important points, whether it's single parents or working parents or just busy parents. We really need to talk to our caregivers and pick out summer programs that will help meet the children's needs. Of course, the needs I worry about first are their nutrition needs and their needs for physical activity. But as Connie, the first caller, pointed out, also their intellectual needs to sort of keep up the learning that went on with the school year. So, child care options sometimes are different over the summer. Sometimes you have after-school babysitters who aren't available during the summer or this or that. So, it can be a real challenge just to make sure the kids are always well-supervised and safe. And, of course, you want safety to come first. But then also as you're evaluating your options as a parent for the summer, please do try to give preference to programs and child care providers who will help your kids be active and eat healthfully during the summer months as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Kate in Viroqua has a comment or question. Let's go to Kate. Hi, Kate.
Hi there, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's great to be on. So, Sue, I'm a nutrition educator right now for part-time AmeriCorps program with Farm to School. I don't know, maybe you've heard of it.
Oh, yes, very much.
Yeah, and so I've been working here in Vernon County, and this is great because I've been working through the school year, and I've been in classrooms, but now summer is here, and I've been confronted with, well, what do we do with the children in the summer? And I agree with what you said earlier about children having so much screen time, and they're just not sitting still. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on maybe encouraging children to become more interested in the outdoors, but also more specifically gardening and farming, because along with that is activity and activeness outdoors. They also have the experience of growing nutritional food, vegetables and fruits, which is really as healthy as you can get when it comes to food.
Yes, Kate, thanks so much for bringing that up. And congratulations on the good work you do. Those farm-to-school programs are, you know, they have a lot of obstacles to overcome, and they just do great work to help kids have, you know, healthy snacks or aspects for their school lunch programs and support local farmers in the process. And actually, that reminds me that there's a kind of a research study going on this summer in cooperation with Troy Gardens. I mentioned Dr. Erin Carroll and Dr. Alex Adams from our pediatrics. She's from the medical school from the family medicine department. They've put together a little study about whether getting kids involved in gardening over the summer, and they're having the kids work in cooperation with Troy Gardens here in Madison. To help them not only learn where their food comes from and keep them busy in the gardens, but also to keep them active and getting physical activity and eating more healthful fruits and vegetables. So that actual study is ongoing right now, and if they get the results they expect to, then I think Kate's points about gardening and helping with tilling the crops or what's in the garden and that sort of thing, and harvesting is beneficial from a number of aspects, including the child's own physical health.
Yeah. Good points, Kate. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Interesting to watch. I watched on the news the other night, Michelle Obama. Working in the garden with a big group of youngsters gathering in some of the fruits of their labor.
Yeah, I think they were fifth graders. I think I saw the same news clip, and you know, I think it's a great role model and helps us think about how we can use gardens not just for having a more interesting salad with our dinner, but also for helping our kids learn where food comes from, learn how food is raised, and also gain an appreciation of the kinds of fruits and vegetables they like because they're involved in the production of them, and burn off some calories and get some exercise in the process.
Absolutely. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And email came in wondering, going back to that study that we talked about earlier, the person was wondering if in the study, did the researchers account for weight gain due to normal growth? You know, over the summer, kids are growing at that age.
Right. I was actually reviewing the study this morning and getting ready for the radio show. The first author is Paul von Hippel, H-I-P-P-E-L. And this was published in the American Journal of Public Health in April of 2007. And actually, they have a whole page of the statistics that they use to adjust for and correct for just that possible effect, as the emailer mentioned. So, they had a very sophisticated team of researchers that this was actually a subsample from a large nationwide study of all kinds of child development factors that are being followed over time. Mm-hmm. So they actually had access to the resources to do a real good job with the statistics on that and make sure that what they were reporting was accurate and, you know, well thought through.
Yeah. Another email, is there any evidence that growth hormones in cattle feed is reaching humans to account for the gain?
Well, I think that's quite unlikely for a number of reasons. Let me see, how should I start? First of all, when growth hormones are given to cattle, it's by injection. Mm-hmm. And the amount that shows up in the cow's bloodstream is within the normal levels that are seen during the cow's natural cycle of producing milk after having a calf, et cetera.
Okay.
So it's not an unusual amount of growth hormone that shows up in the milk after the cow is injected with the growth hormone. And I believe there's a requirement that the injections have to be timed in such a way that minimizes that effect as well. And also, it was very thoroughly studied before the growth hormone procedure was allowed to be used by the Food and Drug Administration or the U.S. Department of Agriculture. I can't remember which regulatory agency was responsible for that approval. And, of course, there is what they call a BST-free milk or whatever mm-hmm. the name of it is still pretty widely available in the market. And I wouldn't let's just say that for a minute we suspend all my disbelief anyway and say that that had a real effect. Mm-hmm. I would think it would be unusual for it to be a different effect over the summer than over the winter during the school year, because I would think actually studies show that kids actually drink more milk if they take school lunch than if they bring lunch from home. And from other studies that I've seen, I think kids actually are, if their milk intake is different over the summer, it's probably more kids drinking less milk than there are the other way around. So okay. For a number of reasons, I think that's probably not a major issue behind this. But, you know, I'm glad the caller is trying to, that's one of the things that, you know, we do as scientists, Larry, is try to think, you know, did we miss anything? Is there something else that could explain what we found? And usually when you're writing up a journal article, you have a section at the end about strengths and weaknesses, and mm-hmm. and you explore some of those other possible explanations for what you saw. And that's what all good critically thinking scientists do. So that caller was, or emailer, I applaud her thinking about, you know, what else could this have been?
Yeah. And you can join in, too, at email at talk@WPR.org or call us at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Jake in Oshkosh next. Jake, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
No problem. I think that one of the main reasons is that the availability of and pricing structure of nutritious food in contrast to unnutritious food is not correct. I think that there's a lot of deferred costs in unnutritious food. For instance, a bag of Doritos can cost less than a head of lettuce or other nutritious items. I think that a lot of the costs come on the backside. You know, with the fact that we're now having to study obesity, these kids are malnutritious. Another thing is, you know, I've heard of people in the Appalachian Mountains that are feeding their kids Mountain Dew because it's cheaper than milk.
Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with that?
Yeah.
You know, you've hit on one of my hot buttons. The beverages that are served to children these days, it just disturbs me greatly. I actually am writing a book in cooperation with some other authors who are experts in child development, and it's a book about nutrition for preschool. Hmm. And we make a big deal in there about the beverages that are served during the day in a child care setting. What we recommend, it's not the only way to do it, but a way that makes sense to us is if you think of serving milk with a meal and low-fat milk.
Yeah.
And then having kids drink water between meals. And if you want to make the water special, put a lime slice in it or a piece of a cucumber slice or something kind of grown up and special. But I think the marketing of the energy drinks and the, you know, vitamin waters and even Mountain Dew It's just amazing how people will reach for those drinks all day long during the day. And I think we've talked earlier about other calorie sources that are just liquid that we just forget about, and they don't really satisfy our appetite as well as solid foods do, and they can really make the difference, in a big daily difference in our calorie intakes. So thanks to Jake for bringing that up.
Yeah, thanks a lot,
and
Jake.
He also mentioned the price of nutritious foods.
There's another point.
You know, there's a lot of nationwide interest in that right now. And Adam Drnowski from one of the universities in California has been doing research to actually verify how much it costs to make nutritious food choices versus buying junk food to satisfy mm-hmm. your hunger. And on a per-calorie basis, nutritious foods often do tend to be more expensive.
Yeah.
I think it's part of what we see, but I think it's... I also see some people who are maybe a little too ready to blame that as the most major factor, because I think a lot of people do really well at picking out nutritious foods, especially in the summer when fresh fruits and vegetables, right now strawberries are such a delicious treat. And they're not that expensive. And, you know, the local foods that we have access to during the summer, I think, help to mitigate that. And with a little work, I think we could all stay within our food budgets and think about, next time I pick out a snack, what's it going to be? And you could probably find a good healthy alternative.
Some of it, too, may be that the sort of junk, quote-unquote, junk foods are easy.
Well, the convenience factor is absolutely critical. You're absolutely right. And one of the things that we recommend to parents is when you're thinking about your kids being home either after school or during the summer, what's the most convenient thing for them to grab if they're hungry or thirsty? And because that's what's likely to happen.
Sure.
And if the most convenient thing is right now, this time of year, maybe a bowl of plums on the kitchen counter,
mm-hmm.
I would promote that versus, a bag of chips that are grabbed out of the pantry or off the shelves. So if you think about making the most nutritious choices the most convenient, I think that's actually part of what I would encourage as thinking about ways to overcome the phenomenon we're talking about.
Thanks again, Jake, for calling. George in Fox Cities, we'll turn to you next. George, hello.
Hello, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Just one quick question in regards to the relative amount of corn syrup that's being pumped into all the variety of foods, becoming more and more educated over time as my daughter's having an issue, and it seems as though it's just becoming more and more prevalent, even in organic, or quote-unquote, the misused or overused word, organic foods. And I'm just curious if that's also contributing or been studied.
Yes, George, it has been studied. And the current evidence that we have shows that high fructose corn syrup, which is just like the cheapest way to sweeten your soda or lemonade or whatever you're making as a commercial product, really is very comparable to sucrose or table sugar in the way it affects the body and even in its composition. So I agree that we probably are eating a whole lot more than we need to of foods that are sweetened with high fructose corn syrup. But I've actually come across people who switch to the same kind of food like pop, sweetened mm-hmm. with sucrose, thinking that that's going to be better for them. And I think that's probably a waste of time and energy. I think the real, the most important thing to think about is, where are all the sources of added sugar in my diet or my child's diet, and how can I minimize those? So whether the added sugar is in the form of sucrose or table sugar, or whether it's in the form of high fructose corn syrup or some of the other sweeteners on the market, I think is probably, you know, it might play a role, but it's way less of an important factor than just cutting down the total amount of what my pyramid and the dietary guidelines call added sugars, which are way too plentiful in our diets.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, George. Anita in rural Wisconsin Dells. We'll turn to you now. Hi, Anita.
Hi. I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself. I just tuned in to the station, and it's very interesting to me. I'm concerned about the same thing that the previous gentleman talked about. Why do we have to have all this sweetener in our dairy products at all? It bothers me that children are eating this high fructose chocolate milk on a regular basis. It used to be once a week. Now it's every day. the strawberry. I've tasted it. It's all full of sweetener. And I think this makes the child's palate wanting more and more and more of this sweet stuff in everything they eat. That bothers me a lot. Mm-hmm. The other thing that bothers me a lot is that everything that the kids are eating is package, package, package. I think we need to get away from that. I think it takes away from the quality of taste, and it's expensive, and it's filling our landfills with garbage. The other thing that bothers me is this BGH that you spoke about. Well, maybe a little bit in one thing that we get. But we get it in chickens, we get it in pork, we get it in everything. Do we really know what this is going to do to us?
All right, several comments here from Anita. Mm-hmm. And Sue, how do you respond?
Anita's first point was about the flavored milks, the strawberry milk, the chocolate milk, et cetera. Yeah. And, you know, nutritionists discuss this. I've been a professional nutritionist for, I don't know, 30, 40 years. And, you know, we were talking about it then, we're talking about it now. It's kind of a conundrum because studies show that kids are more likely to drink their milk if it's flavored milk. And, of course, the perfect thing would be is if they all drank low-fat or skim milk after the age of two. And I think if you put it up next to Mountain Dew or some of the other products we were mentioning on the virtuous continuum from true garbage to the best, you know, chocolate or strawberry or whatever the flavored milk is would be toward the better end of the continuum. I do agree with Anita that the better choice still would be the unflavored milk, and having your kids used to drinking just regular low-fat white milk with their meals, I think, is a wonderful thing that we could all probably do a little bit better job of. She also mentioned that the growth hormones, and I think there's probably a little bit of mix-up in terminology here. There's some with chickens and pork and things. Sometimes antibiotics and other growth promoters are used in the production of animals. And as a general rule, I think there is some merit to the idea that it would be best if we just sort of just fed them and kept them healthy without all these gimmicks and that sort of thing. My friends in the production agriculture field quickly point out to me that, you know, the economics of producing affordable food in that manner might quickly become a problem, you know, if we didn't use any growth promoters, et cetera. And, you know, it's just, it's really an issue that I'm glad consumers are tuning into and our agencies are keeping track of so that it, the health effects are undetectable. But still, it's something to monitor and be aware of, although I can't really cite any evidence that shows that that the regular pork and chicken and meat in our food supply, whether it's organic or not, I think is... there's no demonstrable differences. And probably if you look at the advice of the dietary guidelines and the advice of nutrition experts, the main thing is to watch your portion sizes and to eliminate the, you know, the fattiness of the meats that we're eating. You know, trim them better. Don't have fried chicken wings is the only way you the only way you eat chicken and that sort of thing. So, you know, it's like so many things, a very complicated mix of factors.
You know, you've given some suggestions, I think, for to keep people or keep children active and well fed during the summer. I know you talked about trying to be active with your children. We talked about keeping junk food out of the house and making other foods that are, you know, great alternatives the most convenient to get to. What are a couple of other points that we might mention?
Yeah, you know, one of the things, whether it's summer or winter, we're really spending more time promoting family meals. And hopefully not something you picked up at a fast food restaurant on the way home, but or at least maybe from a deli would be all right. But Getting families back to eating together. Studies show that children are more likely to have milk and vegetables as part of their meal when they sit down with their parents and eat a meal as a family. So for a number of reasons, we just really kind of long for families to think about ways of having more of their meals together at home whenever they can. Also, look for the playgrounds and the activities in your area. If you call your local park and recs department, if you're in a city, or your county public health office, many of them are compiling lists of programs that are available to kids in the area so that they can have swimming lessons or you know, soccer practice or whatever during the summer. All of those are great ideas.
A great treat to have you with us, Sue, and thank you so much. And you'll come back and do this again, I'm sure. We'll talk some more.
I'd love to.
All right. Sue Nitzke, UW-Madison and UW Extension Professor of Nutritional Science, our guest today. Really pleased to have her with us, and thank you for listening. Don't forget, I'll be in Stevens Point along with several of my colleagues. We'll be broadcasting beginning at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning from the Midwest Renewable Energy Association. And I'm really looking forward to that. If you're in the area, please come by, sit in our tent, say hello. I'd love to talk to you. And thanks for listening today, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.